goes on backwards, you can adjust here.
Good. Doc, alcoholic. Yeah, I will adjust as such. Let me get my... I thank God they wrote it down. Because without this, we would have too many people babbling about what their opinion of sobriety is, how to achieve it, and what you're supposed to do once you have attained it. I don't know everything that works, but I know a lot of stuff that doesn't work. I also know that they only put the stuff that works in here. So you can be absolutely assured that if you read it in either of these books, it will in fact work. I want to tell you just a little bit about my sobriety and my road to getting here. My sobriety date is February 22nd, 1990. I picked 22nd of February because I didn't get sober in AA. I got sober one day before my first meeting, and I didn't know anything that AA did, because first of all, I had no interest in you guys at all anyway, because you're a bunch of quitters, and I didn't want to have anything to do with you. I thought that maybe it would be a good idea to remember the day I got sober, so I kind of put it off and waited till all the numbers matched, and I got 222, and I thought that'll be easy to remember, because maybe years from now I'll want to remember what day I actually started this. I didn't know it was a real journey, and I'll tell you a little about that in a moment. Right, I started doing drugs when I was 1 year old. I took an entire box of over-the-counter amphetamines that were legal in those days, and apparently they had to pump my stomach as a one-year-old. Oh, I'm sorry, wait, we have singleness of purpose. Let me start over. I started drinking when I was 1 year old. They tell me by crawling around the room and emptying the beer bottles that my dad and his buddies would have next to their chair. And one of our great family stories is how I guzzled down one of the bottles, swallowed a cigarette butt, and then projectile vomited on the living room carpet to the horror of my parents and the amusement of his friends. But, like, who hasn't done that, right? I mean, come on. I don't know what either of those things, I do know what they mean now, but I didn't know what they meant. I just put them in as something that happened when I was one. Later in sobriety, I realized that babies usually nurse on bottles when they're 1 year old. That's why you give them sippy cups, because they don't know how to drink. They only know how to suck, except I must have known how to drink, because the only way to guzzle a cigarette butt down is to be, in fact, guzzling the beer. And apparently, that's what I did. If I was drinking it like a baby, I would have hit the cigarette butt and stopped. But I knew how to drink instinctively from birth, apparently, which is open your throat and fill your body from the tips of your toes to the top of your head. And when the alcohol comes out of you, you take a breath and refill the empty area with more alcohol. And that's how I drank. I'm not going to go through all my story, primarily because we all have stories. And also, my stories are really deep, bizarre, and awful, yet they always end where I survive, and they're pretty amusing. So I usually don't tell newcomers my stories at all, because it actually sounds like, well, why did you give it up? It sounds pretty good. What it involved was, it involved dropping out of school, coming home and drinking everything in the liquor cabinet. It included crimes and misdemeanors and car thefts and overnights in the jail and check forgery and false bank accounts and graduation from high school. And after that, I did other things. I ended up being in the entertainment industry, and I toured with Alice Cooper and Aerosmith and Black Sabbath and Frankie Beverly and Maze and Kool and the Gang. And in those days, by the way, drinking and drugging were synonymous with each other, so there was no separation. And scotch and cocaine are, in fact, the same thing, just in different forms. I think you can find that in the big book where it says alcohol in all its forms, and it's talking about that. We never thought of that as abuse, by the way. It turns out to be the same kind of story alcoholics always like to tell, which is, I'm different, I'm special, I've got a pass, my story enables me to drink in a way that you normal people will never understand. And that's what being in this industry was, because it was all about us and then them, those crowds of thousands, 10,000s, 100,000 people that are drinking and drugging in a manner that is not very professional, I should probably say. We were professionals. We knew how to do it regularly, daily, and it never got in the way of anything. So when I finally got here, I got here because I met an angel in distress, and I rescued this beauty, and she had a drinking problem, and I dropped her off at an AA meeting. She was, as you can guess, because it fits so many of our stories, she was absolutely beautiful, brilliant, homicidally dangerous, and had all the features I just absolutely adore in a woman. And I, at one point, after all of the sorrows and the sorries and everything that the doctor's opinion talks about, after a spree, emerging remorseful, promising never to do it again, and then it's repeated over and over. And that's what happened. So I took her to an AA meeting, and I dropped her off in 1990. And I dropped her off, and I went across the street to a bar and waited for her, right? Which is what we do. It was in Phoenix, Arizona. It's called the Bottlenose. And it was in reference to a dolphin, apparently. So I smoked a joint, and I thought, and I looked at my watch, and so I rolled another joint, and then said, well, I should probably go inside. And I had a beer and a shot, and there was still a lot of time, so I had another beer and another shot, and then there was time enough to drink one more beer, go into my car, finish that joint, and then drive across the street to pick her up. Now, what's awesome to me at this point in my talk is that everyone in this entire banquet room kind of went, yeah, that sounds about right. That would be about an hour of wait time. Couple joints, three shots, four or five beers. That sounds about an hour. So no one here is shocked with how much I was doing waiting an hour, yet if I tell that to any of those people out there, they are horrified. No wonder you need Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, I didn't need Alcoholics Anonymous. I was doing just fine. And it was my girlfriend, actually fiance, because after she broke the bottle over my head and I passed out on the kitchen floor and woke up in dried blood and she had left me there, I realized that I just couldn't part with her, that truly, she was so, it just hurt me so bad that I knew I couldn't live without her. Now, I could kill her, but I could not break up with her, and I know every member of AA has had that feeling once or so in their life, that it's just, I'm too involved emotionally with this person to break up, but I just one good smack with a log from the fireplace while she's passed out, and all my troubles would be over. But anyway, I asked her to marry me, and when I went to pick her up, there was a bunch of you people out there in the parking lot, because in those days they actually had an AA store there where you could buy chips and trinkets and medallions and cool stuff. And it was next to the little strip mall that had the meeting. And they were all, you know, fake smiles and acting like they were having a good time, as most of cult members do. And so I pulled up in my not stolen car. It wasn't actually my car. And the reason it was a 1972 Riviera with 1968 plates in 1990. And the reason I couldn't get it registered is because I didn't have any paperwork on it. And in fact, I'm pretty sure I didn't have a key. But, excuse me, I pulled up and I rolled down the window a little bit because there were a lot of you people in the parking lot. And I knew this was a disease, and I didn't want to catch the disease, so I only rolled down the window a little bit. And I said, and make no mistake, it is a disease. The American Medical Association deemed it a disease quite a number of decades ago because it fits the requisites for a disease. There are five different requisites that something has to meet in order to be labeled a disease, and alcoholism actually does fit all of those. Two of those are, it's a progression. There's a progression involved in it. It's progressive. Another one is there is actual treatment that works. And it's the only disease, by the way, that the American Medical Association accepted as God or a higher power being the treatment to this actual disease. So we're really pretty blessed that we have the only disease known to man that the only known cure is God. So, but I didn't know that then. I just thought it was a regular disease. So I only rolled down a little bit, and she came over. She says, come on out. They want to meet you. Now, that means two things. One is I don't want to catch the disease. I don't want to get out and talk to them. And two, if they want to meet me, she's been talking about me. And if she's been talking about me, she's been lying. So I don't want to meet anybody. Just get in the car. 30 days later, one of the cult leaders told her she had to leave my apartment. And it was a beautiful basement apartment that I actually didn't rent. It was my apartment. Well, it wasn't really my apartment either. I actually just paid the rent on it because my friend left. And he said, if you'll just shove the cash under the door to the manager's office in this apartment building, you can keep the apartment. So I just kind of took it over. She thought Larry still had the apartment. So, and it was a windowless apartment, but because it was in a basement, but it was still gorgeous, right? It was beautiful, and I don't know why she would want to leave such a wonderful life as living in a basement apartment and driving around in a 72 Riviera that doesn't have any paperwork on it. But she did. And I said, why are you leaving? I don't get it. She said, well, my sponsor. I said, what's that? Well, that's one of the co-cult leaders. Okay, I get it. They assign each new recruit their own cult leader. And she told me, I can't be around you because you drink beer. I said, wait a minute. I don't have the problem. You have the problem. I took you to AA. How dare, I don't get it. I'm not an alcoholic. Why am I being punished? I'm not a drug addict. All I do is drink a little beer. I have stopped everything because I'm with you. So just so that you don't get tempted, because I know how you diseased people are, you cannot walk by a bottle without falling into it. So I only have beer and no drugs either. I have not shot up heroin in years. I haven't done any cocaine in any form. I haven't ingested it, smoked it, snorted it, licked it, or chased the dragon. I haven't done Quaaludes or Seconals or Tuinols or Valiums or any of those fun things, or Reds or Black Beauties or White Crosses or any of those. And I'm not a drug addict. I just used them when I needed them. And I am only smoking a little bit of a flower which God gave to the world to calm us all down, you know, God's little gift called marijuana, and a little bit of beer, which isn't even alcohol. Because, like, I've known guys that have drank a case of beer every day for 20 years, and they're not alcoholics, so it doesn't, why are you leaving? And she said, well, you have to be at zero. I said, no problem. And she said, well, I'm still gone. And she packed up and left. And I said, I'll be at zero before the end of the week. And I couldn't quite do that on the first day. And that's when I started trying planning what day zero would come on, right? It's now the 15th, okay, the 16th, I'll try. You know what? As soon as this bag is gone, I'm done. And then, well, I need a little more. As soon as those beers are out, I'm not buying any more. Except I noticed I started getting a very weird feeling, right? Like that, like I couldn't breathe. So I had seen, and this is true, I had seen a James Cagney movie from the 1930s, before any of this was invented. And I'm being sarcastic. I don't believe this was invented. I believe this is a miracle from God. But anyway, back to my story. Before, at that time, I thought it was all invented. And I had seen this movie. And this movie, the way you got sober is Jimmy Cagney grabbed you by the collar and then slapped you a few times. And then he shook you and said, get a hold of yourself. And then he threw you in the room and locked the door and left you there. And in 3 days, you were sober. Right? And that's how it worked in those days. But there was a scene in that movie where Jimmy Cagney showed his friend that there were a couple of bottles of J&B up in the cabinet, open there. He said, because if we don't have, I don't do a Jimmy Cagney impression, and most young people don't know who the hell Jimmy Cagney is anyway. But he says, if I didn't have it, he'd go insane. So I thought, well, that's true. I got to have some beer in the refrigerator or I will go insane. So my only reference for recovery was a 1933 Jimmy Cagney movie, all right? And I couldn't get to zero. I couldn't just not have a beer, right? I didn't drink any of the real alcohol, but I couldn't just go without just a beer, right? And I believe in singleness of purpose in this organization. I believe that if we start dulling that absolutely razor-sharp fine point of alcoholics and alcoholism, if we start dulling that by including alcoholism and drug addiction and sexual addiction and bad behavior, and we start dulling that scalpel, and it's very difficult to get a point across. But I know that all of my behavior is behind that point. That point of being an alcoholic, behind it is me smoking weed, doing drugs, sleeping with crazy women, and thievery, right? Small felonies that you can get away with. But I wasn't an alcoholic. I just couldn't get to zero. I later have shared at meetings that 99% is never a good thing. If you try to launch a rocket and it's 99% launched, it's a failure. If you get in an airplane and the captain comes on and says, well, we're 99% off the ground, you're doomed, right? This book says half measures avail us nothing. It means 99% avails us nothing. Because this book is written in a Platonic manner. It either is or it isn't. It's all or it's nothing. Right? God is or he isn't. He's everything or he's nothing. What's it to be? You're either going to live by spiritual principles or you're going to die an alcoholic death. You know, and God bless those that aren't here who are dying that alcoholic death. Some of them counting days at meetings and still dying that alcoholic death. God bless them, but those alcoholic deaths rarely come quickly. There are very few alcoholic deaths that I know where people went out and then they were dead. Mostly, they go out and they stay out. And it's a long and painful death, alcoholic death is. So I was reading a book, a little bit about my background. I'm a parapsychologist, which is like we believe in ESP stuff, right? And my degree, I have a doctorate of divinity from the University of New Mexico, not from the $19 get a doctorate online. Not that I don't have one of those, I do, it's just not in this name. And figure that one out. That's true. But I see things in this book that are very esoteric. I see a little bit of how the spiritual world operates written in these two books. Bill Wilson shared the fact that the symbol that we came up with, the circle with the three-sided 60-degree triangle, had deep meaning. He said that first the circle, they both represented many things, but one of the things the circle represents is an oroboso, which is a snake eating its own tail, which is that you die and you're reborn, and that everything is forgiven every single day, and that there is no destruction of pure energy, right? And it's an old thought, and it's both spiritual and it applies to physics today. And the triangle, he said, represents many different things. And one of them is, they purposely selected it and positioned it that way because it is an ancient symbol for the element of fire. And that now we see, of course, if you read through the book, that in metallurgy, the only way to remove gold from ore is with lots of fire. And that later became, of course, meaning heat to a metallurgist. And to us, of course, fire represents energy, which is never ending. We can't create it and we can't destroy it. It's here forever, and it was created for us. It didn't just happen. We can't figure out where all this energy came from. I couldn't get to zero, but I had a book that was about, I was still studying, I didn't have the degree I have now, and I was still studying, it was really about Paul the Apostle. And I was reading about this guy who had a mission in Chile, and he'd arrived, and nobody there showed up to greet him. The guy said, "That's your Jeep," and you drive through the jungle, and the mission is on the other side of the jungle, and he put his little kids and his wife in the Jeep, and halfway through the trip, they break the axle in the muddy road of the Chilean jungles. And he gets out, and there's no body and no axle, and he's just frustrated. And his wife said, she quotes Paul, the Apostle Paul, and says, "Rejoice in all this. Again, I say, rejoice." And I read that, and I thought, well, that's just stupid. And then I read a little more, and the missionary, he kind of said that to his wife. He goes, "That's ridiculous. Paul didn't mean that, nor would God ever say that to someone who has a broken axle, little kids, and a wife in the mud in the Chilean jungle. He would not say, rejoice." And she said, "Oh, yes, he would. That's exactly what it means." Now, I was literally breaking up buds on that book, so I didn't slap the book shut, but I carefully set it aside and took a drink off that big Foster can. And I was sitting on the bed and I thought, God can't mean he wants me to rejoice in the fact that I can't get to zero, that I have to have something to take the edge off every day, right? Just a little something. I can't make it through the day completely alone. And I heard in my head, it says, you know, no. He does want you to rejoice. And I kind of felt angry at that point. And I kind of felt like, all right, watch this. I will rejoice. And I did. I said, okay. And I had my little pipe, my Popeye-looking marijuana pipe, and my big can of Foster's. And I said, great. I rejoice. I am so overwhelmed with happiness that I cannot even pray to the ceiling, and that I have nothing to lose. I can't say I've lost everything. I only lost her. I've got nothing anyway. Rejoice. And then, at the time, I thought it was my crazy brain talking. Today, I know it was God, and that's how what the book calls the sunlight of the Spirit speaks to us inside our own ear. And we only kind of notice it after it's over, and not those people will never know what it's like, right? They think, really, you talk to God? Well, mostly I listen. I did do most of the talking the first few years, and then I learned how to just shut up and listen, be still. But I thought it was my crazy head that said, if you will ask me, I'll remove this, and you will help thousands of people. And that's when I knew it was my crazy head, because that had nothing to do with the subject, right? I had nothing to do with helping people. What is that about? That's just crazy doc brain, right? So I said, fine. I got down on my knees right there, and I said, God, if take this away, please. You can have it all. I don't want anything. I don't want to be dependent on anything. And I have not had a drink or a drug since that moment in my life. Now that's pure, thank you, that's God. That's an awesome God thing. But that's exactly what the book says. I'd never read it in the book. I'm not a product of reading it, understanding it, doing it, and getting the result. I'm a product of being given the grace before I ever saw a big book, where he gave me the answer first and then said, now, let me show you how that happened. And now today, I share with people, and I do step series and big book studies, and I speak at other events around, and people often come up and say, wow, that was wonderful. You opened my eyes to so many things. That's great. I appreciate that, but that's not me. That's the gift God put in me at that moment when he said, and you will help other people. That wasn't a prophecy. That was a commandment. And he says, he didn't have to explain at the time, I will give you the way to share it. I will tell you what to say. I will show you where it is in the book. I'll give you the confidence and the strength to stand up and share it without mumbling and being afraid. He didn't say all that, but I know that's what happened. And I found out later that that's what he's done with everything, is every single thing, he gives me every tool I need. Now, I'm not a big fan of recovery for money, right? I'm not a big fan. I'm sure it helps with a lot of other stuff to know about your childhood fears and the little emotional twists that gave us really big, messed up thinking. I'm sure that's helpful in a lot of arenas, but it does not help anyone get sober. There's one and only one treatment for alcoholism, and that's a power greater than ourselves. Which, it's not that I choose to call him God. The book tells me it's God. That one is God. May you find him now. Not, I hope you find him someday. Right now. When did I want to get loaded? Right now. I've never sat at a bar where the bartender says, I'll get you a drink one of these days. All right. Well, you know, I'm a work in progress. Give me a drink when you get to it. You know, I'm pretty easy going. No, when I sat down at a bar, usually before I sat down at the bar, as I was approaching that bar stool, and I seldom sat in the new, cushy, lovely bar stools. It was almost always the bar stools with the cracks and tears and the squeaks, you know, and the lumps. And you sit down there, and it's just like the bar rail, that brass rail, is worn from people sitting and leaning there for so many years, you know? That's the place I like to drink, right? And Al turns around and goes, what do you have, Doc? Right? In fact, I didn't think I was an alcoholic when I got here, but somebody told me at a meeting, they said, did you have a special glass in a bar? Oh, yeah. I had those big quart beer mugs with my name etched in it in 5 different bars. And I didn't remember that at all, right? But when I walked in, the bartender would just take it, fill it, and set it down. But I'm not an alcoholic. I had drinking down to a science, but I'm not an alcoholic, right? When I say a science, when light beer came out in the 80s, we thought, this is awesome, half the calories. Means I can drink twice as much, still be healthy. Because we used to go to the gym and then go to Senior Frogs. And then we thought, well, we'll just do a little rail of Coke, then go to the gym, then go to Senior Frogs. Then it was, let's just get up for the game, we used to call it, and let's get ready and go to Senior Frogs. And we started skipping the gym till after Senior Frogs and just going to the jacuzzi, which is much better. And so to stay in shape, we drank light beer until I found out that the way they made this new incredible invention in the early 80s, light beer, was to cut it in half with water. Half the calories, half the alcohol. Immediately, I did research, not too easy to do in 1982, but I came up with the most alcohol per 12-ounce can in America is our domestic favorite Pabst Blue Ribbon. Fuck Heineken! Pabst Blue Ribbon, man! It's supposed to be 6.4%. And not more by law, but Pabst Blue Ribbon often broke 7.5%, 8% alcohol. That's like wine, man. That's great. I moved away from light beer, went right to PBR because of science, the science of drinking, right? I understood all that. Now, today, I understand this. There, the number 3 pops up a lot in spiritual writings and in mystic writings, and it's no different in the big book in the 12 and 12. The number 3 is repeated 4 times, just like the seasons we have in the steps. Each season has 3 steps, right? There's so many different things. Our equilateral triangle, our 60% triangle, 60 degree triangle, is 3-sided. So I'm going to tell you just 3 quick points that if I had to share with someone, whether they be new or whether they have time, it would be what I would share with them. And that is, first of all, that when I come in here, my attitude is set up with, I'm first, others are second, God's third. That's how we come in here. I've yet to see an exception to that, because the story is almost always, I need to get sober for me. Right? There are too many things that went wrong in my life. I need to get sober. Oh, wait. It did affect my family and friends, and I love them. They are on the ticket, but I'm first, and they're second. And God is in my life, but he's third. It's me, you, and God, and that's how we come in. It's been explained in a lot of other writers going back thousands of years how that works, how there is what's known as carnal man, right? Who lives in this life, his life first. And then there are others, and then there's God. But we often, as alcoholics, we know that, but we have a much nobler viewpoint of why we do that rather than I'm self-centered, that's why I'm always first. Now, the disease may cause that, but we have this noble viewpoint of God is not first in my life because I'm not important enough for God to need to deal with me. God has much more important things to deal with. All the countries that are in turmoil, all the poverty around the world, all those dying of diseases, God needs to be there. For me to ask God to be first in my life would be selfish. And now that I think of it, my friends are a little more important than me. I don't need them to be focusing on my alcoholism, so they can be second. I need to be the one that takes care of my own problem. And that's a very noble look. It makes us think that we're only first out of selflessness. But it's not true. We come in here, I am first, you are second, God is third. When we leave, hopefully it is God is first, others are second, and I am third. Gail Sayers' autobiography was entitled, I Am Third. And if you don't know who Gail Sayers was, you should find out. Awesome, awesome dude. Our 12 steps reflect that. The first step talks all about you and how you have to come to an understanding with yourself. But the 12th step tells us God is first, others are second, you are third. What it says is, here, let me find it right here, so I'm sure that I get every word correctly. Right? In step 12, having had a spiritual awakening, that's God. Our spiritual awakenings are not earned by good deeds, or as others say, by works. Our spiritual awakening is free, it's grace. It's poured on us every minute of every day if we don't block it. And that's what the book talks about, is that by doing these steps, it removes the blockage and allows His grace to fall on us, which is what makes us sober and keeps us sober. 12 steps don't get us sober. The 12 steps don't keep us sober. The 12 steps enable us to remove the blockage so that the cure can fall on us. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, right? Having gotten pure, clear drinking water because we use the steps to remove the blockage in the canal or the stream of life, that's God. We tried to carry this message to alcoholics, that's others. And to practice these principles, what we've learned, the good works, the good deeds, in all our affairs. So now, the way I live, if I've done the 12th step correctly, I am third, and I am living to help others, to serve God, to practice these principles. If we're not too sure about that, the 12th tradition tells us too, exactly that. It doesn't, when it says, and practice, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions. What the heck does that even mean? How is that possible? That me being anonymous is the spiritual foundation of all this? That's ridiculous. No, if you read on, it'll tell you what it means. It means, remember, we practice principles before personalities. Now, I know a whole lot of people, 4 out of 5 dentists and 8 out of 10 alcoholics, misunderstand what that means. And when they get pissed off at somebody, they go, Joe, settle down. Remember, it's principles before personalities. Well, that's not what it means. The personality part in there is not everybody else. It's you. You are the personality that is supposed to come behind the principles, which is the good deeds, which means do your good works anonymously. Man, in the old Little River, don't get me wrong, I like the new Little River, but I like that old Little River building because they had the nastiest bathrooms in Dade County. And in old days, Railroad Bob will tell you this is true. I had a bucket. I went and bought a bucket and a toilet scrubber and gloves and stuff to clean a bathroom with. And I put them all, and a mop, and put them all in the bucket and labeled it Doc's Bucket, and it went behind the coffee bar. And when I got sponsees, it started telling me the way things ought to be and started telling me who was on their S hit list. How'd I do with that one, right? I changed hit list, or I changed it around. The S-hit list. When you got one of those of who you were offended by, I say, you know what? I've got a project for you. What you need to do is go down to the coffee bar at Little River, ask them for Doc's Bucket, have them point you to the men and women's room, clean both of them thoroughly as if they were kitchens, return the buck to the coffee bar, and go home. And you're not allowed to tell anyone you were the one that cleaned it up. You don't get to go in there at a meeting and go, dude, I just cleaned this. This is all my work. What do you say? No, you have to shut up and just do principles before personalities, right? The reason we're here tonight, we have a theme here tonight, which is page 77. And I am so, so grateful Frank asked me to speak, because page 77 is one of my battling cries. Page 77, page 37, both in the big book, and page 58 in the 12 and 12. There are the three things that I would share with someone with time and someone with no time, that if you add those three things, you could put almost everything in the big book together, right? First one is on page 37 in the big book. It is the definition of insanity. By the way, the definition of insanity is not doing the same thing over and over, hoping for different results. That is baloney. That's another one, right? That's another good one. Okay. I'm watching how I'm speaking here. That is baloney. It is not attributed to Einstein, and if it is, it is falsely attributed to Einstein. Einstein would never have said that, right? Because to Einstein, doing the same thing over and over again, looking for a different result, is called the scientific method. It is sanity at its finest. And if you're talking, if that crazy statement is aimed at me, you're really flat out wrong. Because I drank every day, right? I repeated the same thing over and over again. Did I expect different results? Did you expect different results? No! I expected to get drunk. And I got drunk. I never once I crossed that line, I never again went into a bar hoping to drink like a normal guy. The only time I felt that was after I got sober. Then I started thinking, I'm only here long enough to learn how to drink responsibly, and then I'm going back. I'm not going to stay. And I've been here 28 years now. God, thanks a lot for giving me the disease. I appreciate it. Page 37 tells us what insanity really is, right? So when people say, what is insanity then if it's not doing the same thing? Don't even say that. Insanity, by the way, lots of us think that insanity is introduced to us in this program in step two, right? He will return us to sanity. Oh no, 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 no. Insanity is introduced to us in the first step. And it makes only perfect sense. First of all, it's explained in detail in the big book. But just looking at the steps, it makes sense. How can you be returned to something you haven't admitted you have lost? So step one is admitting you've lost sanity completely. And step two is that it can be returned. So you have to know what it is, right? Is insanity just another beautiful attribute that women have? No. It's also my part, right? That was a compliment, by the way. That was not bad. Says whatever the precise definition of the word may be, right? That means whatever your college books say. We call this plain insanity a lack of proportion and a lack of the ability to think straight. How could it be called anything else? Lack of proportion, lack of the ability to think straight. We all still have it. The longer we're here, the less we have it. I can think, you know what? I need to get up there. I need to speak. I need to share what God wants me to share. I need to prepare a little bit so I'm not just standing there waiting for God, that I start riding the bike and then I notice he's pushing me, right? I need to do all that. But what happens is I start to do that, and then I remember, oh yeah, I haven't watered the plants. And then as I start to get water to water the plants, I realize, oh man, I got to return a call that I did. And before long, I'm 16 events away from what my first intention was, right? It's the inability to think straight. Another really good one is when I blame somebody else. And quickly, and we saw it with Cub Scouts. We saw it with Cub Scouts, Ian and Allie and I, at the Ren Fair. These two Cub Scouts were writing secretly between their legs on the wooden benches that they were sitting at. And then the Cub Master dad caught them and snapped at them, right? Give me that pen. That's what's it called? Vandalism. Thank you. All the vandals go, vandalism, man. You still have spray paint stains, I know. Vandalism. And the kid immediately, before the syllable was ended, vandalism, the kid goes, he made me do it. Boom, he made me do it. It was like that. Inability to think straight. See, because I can't stop and go, wait a minute, why am I even writing on it? What gave me this stupid idea? This is wrong. I should, right? Our brain goes, boom, I didn't do it. I wasn't there. You can't prove anything. You didn't see it. Right? Inability to think straight. I can all of a sudden just see something and go, oh, my God, this is her fault. Right? Without even thinking, my brain will go bing, bang, like a pinball machine. Inability to think straight. That's part of our insanity that God can return. The longer we're here, the less we have those problems. The longer we're here, the more we practice these principles in all our affairs, we start seeing that I think this and I do this. See, my thinking is upside down from the very beginning. I come in here, these are the three things again. Normal people, right? They think about something. I think we're going to take a trip to Disneyland. Okay. Then they act. After they've thought, they go, well, how much is that going to cost? It's now up to $116 per kid. We've got four kids. Oh, my gosh. And then we go, okay, well, I guess we'll take that $1,000 at the least to go one day to Disney World. And okay, but we'll do it. Then they act on it. And they go up there and they have a great time. And then after, when they're driving back and the kids are asleep, then they feel about what they did. Right? They have a feeling. They go, that was worth it. That was an awesome day. Or, man, Disney World sucks these days. I don't really. Whatever it is, they feel it. We're backwards. We come in, we feel something, we act on it, then we think about what we did. You ask any alcoholic, why'd you do that? And they will tell you, I felt like it. Why'd you do that? I felt like it. Felt like a good thing. I don't know. I thought it felt good. Felt good. Then I did it. Now I'm thinking about it. I probably should have thought first, right? We have the inability to think straight because we're starting in the wrong position. Now, study that on your own time, and we'll go to lack of proportion. What does that mean? Little things seem enormously big, and big important things seem very incidental. Right? Things like paying the rent, paying your taxes, taking care of things that need to be taken care of, important things don't seem that big of a deal. But, oh my God, I texted her 20 minutes ago and she has still not returned it. I am going to kill her and me and everyone in between us on my way to her place. Right? And that's true. That's how we are. Why? Because I feel like it. That's why. Right? Lack of proportion. Don't you see that's important? Doesn't seem, it's no big deal, man. It's no big deal. What about that thing? Oh, it's a life and death problem. Right? Lack of proportion. That is insanity. How can it be called anything else? All right. How about page 58 in the 12 and 12? That's the definition of humility. Right? I hear a lot of definitions. They're all pretty good, right? I like I'm familiar with the Hallmark card version of humility, which is, it's not thinking of yourself less. Oh, no, I'm sorry. See, I got it backwards already. It's not thinking less of yourself, it's thinking of yourself less. Very Hallmark greeting card definition of humility. The problem with that is, of course, if I reverse it like I just did, I've totally ruined its meaning, and I'm killing myself, right? So that's not a good one. How about, my sponsor used to say, teachable. It means being teachable. Well, that's true. That's pretty good. That's true, okay? But it's not in the literature. And I need, whether that's true or not, I need to have something out of these two books that I can live on, that I know for is a fact. So here it is on page 58 in step 5 in the 12 and 12. It says humility. It says a word, is humility, a word often misunderstood. Then it says, to those who have made progress in AA, right? not to the complainers and the whiners and the relapsers, and but to those who have made progress, this is what humility means. Let's stop right there. Clear is an interesting word. Clear is an interesting word because of this, because of the word serene. Serene is an ancient word. Serene was a word reserved for the use in describing kings and popes. It means crystal clear clarity in vision. Serenity is being able to see crystal clear, and not by your own method, but by God's. So a king or a pope would be given that serenity. It doesn't mean being calm and tranquil. It means having the crystal clear vision that God gives you of something. So when it says here, a clear, that's what it means, a spiritual recognition of exactly what and who we really are. Not what we tell people, what we think we are, what we've convinced ourselves, but a recognition, a clear recognition of exactly what I am, of exactly who I am, followed by a sincere attempt to become what we could be. I've often said, see, I can be a jerk and still be humble. As long as I know I'm a jerk and I'm trying sincerely not to be a jerk, I can still be a jerk and be humble. The trouble with that is not for long. Because if I'm trying really hard, pretty soon I'm practicing principles in all my affairs, and then I can't be a jerk, right? Humility, it's a major component in everything in this book. In step 7, humility is how we heal pain. It says before that, we as alcoholics run from pain as if it were a plague. In modern terms, plague means zombie apocalypse, right? You run from it as if it's a zombie apocalypse. Pain. I will do anything to avoid pain. But see, once I achieve humility through the steps in this book, through this plan, it heals my pain. It heals my pain. It says, and then we fear pain less and desire humility more, right? And what's the last one? The last one is what the theme of this dinner is. It's page 77. Do you know that there are two different purposes in AA and two different meanings of those purposes? If you think about it, you do know it. Our purpose is to what? Is to stay sober and help other alcoholics, right? But that term in purpose, that word translated, is a 13th century word. I'm sorry, a 14th century, from the 1300s, French word, propose, meaning intent, right? It means goal. It means our intent. So our intent, our goal, is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics. That's true. But then there is the purpose of life, the purpose of life. What is the intent of your being? And that becomes something different that actually is only when purpose was used in the 17th century, 300 years later, did it mean reason, that you're the reason, the explanation, the intent that you give something is its purpose. What is the intent God gave you? Beyond doing the purpose of AA, members of AA, our purpose is to stay sober, or we wouldn't have a membership. Stay sober and to help other alcoholics. That's our purpose. That's our intent as members of AA. But what is your purpose as a human being? If you do not have a purpose, if you do not follow what these books suggest, you will not be meeting your true purpose, your real purpose, your God intended, His intent for you. And if you don't, you're at that point purposeless. And to be purposeless is to be lost and to be empty. And there are few places that I can think that are a true definition of purgatory than to be in the middle of this program, cold, stone, sober, and purposeless. It would be empty on top of empty. But we don't have to be that way because the book shows us exactly what our purpose is. Our purpose is on page 77. That's what it says on the bottom of your programs. That's what it says on your tickets tonight. It says, our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. For you young people, the term about means around in that. So it doesn't mean like, what does it mean, people about us? What's about me? No, it means around you, okay? I've had people go, I don't get it. What's about me? What's about us? What are people about us? That doesn't make sense. I could see how that would be crazy. Our real purpose. You know, for years, I read the other definition wrong, and my sponsor called me up driving between Stewart, where he lived, and here, and we were talking on the phone while I was driving, and he says, you know, I discovered something different today. He says, you know the definition of humility? Tell me what it is. I said, sure. It's a clear recognition of exactly what and who we really are, followed by a sincere desire to become all we could be. He goes, yep, that's what I've always said, but that's not true. Hold on, what? He goes, yeah, you just said followed by a sincere desire. And what the words are is followed by a sincere attempt. Big difference. One word changes the meaning entirely. That's why it's written down, right? That's why there's no mistake when we read it. I don't have to listen to an old timer tell me with a sincere desire and it messes up my life. It changes my intent, right? It's a sincere attempt. Well, for the last couple years, I've been misquoting this quote on page 77. I've been telling young people, remember, our real purpose is to be best fitted to be of maximum service to God and those about us. To be best fitted is not what it says. But that sounded like what it should be. God will fit me, which means being outfitted, right? Like in the military. If you're going on a mission, they will fit you. They will outfit you for the mission. Best. You will be equipped with the things you need to accomplish your intent, your purpose. But that's not what it says. It doesn't say to be fitted. It says, our real purpose is to fit ourselves. Holy cow, I have to do something? Yeah, you have to fit yourself to be of maximum purpose, really? Because here you're third, to be of maximum service to God. We're now slaves, we're now servants. It's not a bad thing. Hopefully you have treated every one of the service people that have fed us tonight, right, with poise and dignity. And none of them should go home going, that AA group, what a bunch of dicks, man. I mean, I served them stuff. They kept going, more coffee right here, water. I want more dessert. Can I have another carrot, please? Right, you know? Hopefully we're going, no, we treat servants with dignity. Right? My pastor, he would always tip 25, 30, 40% on a check. I go, Pastor, what are you doing? You don't have any money. He goes, yeah, but I'm God's servant. And for a moment, this person is my servant. And I want to treat my servant with everything I want God to treat me as his servant with. Ooh, I get chills every time I think of that. Right? We are now best fitted. How do we do that? We go back to step three. It's in the 12 and 12. It tells us that giving up our will to God is, in fact, an act of our own will. What? Giving up my will is an act of my own will? Yes, because if you read in that deeper, it says the quality of our willingness. Right? And we spoke at one of my meetings the other day, one of my big book readings, about the difference between qualitative measurements and quantitative measurements. How to understand something by the quality of it or by the quantity of it, right? In science, we use a lot of quantitative assessments, right? It has this much, it does this, it goes this far, it's this big, it's this hot, right? But in spirituality, it's qualitative assessment, right? We don't measure how much of something or how far or how we measure it by the quality of something. The quality of willingness is what step three says in the 12 and 12. Oh, oh my goodness, I had no idea all that stuff was in these two books. More stuff than I could ever decipher, and it's less than 200 pages, both of them. Right? I study books that have 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 pages, and I admittedly am lost in many of them. And we have to, as scholars, we have to specify certain areas of books that big that we're going to study. But here, it's just a few pages, and yet it has so much. And so tonight we gathered for this. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and to the people about us. So let me close with this thought. If I run every one of those, quote, feelings that I get before I act and before I think, if I'm not even able to think first, act, and then feel, I can still run it by this one sentence on page 77. Does it help me fit myself to be of maximum service? And if it says no, maybe I should put it on the shelf or maybe not. But if it says yes, I know to go forward. Does having a new car fit me to be of maximum service? Very possibly yes, depending. How many people you take into meetings? How many meetings are you going to? How many functions do you need your car at? Would you be better serving God if you had a good, dependable new car than that old piece of junk you're driving? The answer is almost invariably yes. And then God provides the new car. Praying only for His intent, right? Praying only for what God wants for us, not praying for ourselves, right? That's what that means. Praying for the things that we need to best serve God and those around us. Does having a nice apartment serve God? Very well might. I'll tell you this. I am of the belief that a brand new Rolls Royce in my driveway or my parking spot at my condo could very well serve God and others. How? Because then I could say, you know what? I stood up in front of a group of people and I said, have absolutely no fear. God will provide everything you need and you will be happy, joyous, and free. There is no doubt. And then God sent me a Rolls Royce to prove it. And if I told everyone that story and newcomers went, no kidding. Damn, I'm going to do that. Only God knows if that will save people's lives. Lives down the road. I can't know. But I'm not saying, I'm not above that. God doesn't want me to squalor in poverty to be of service. He wants me to best fit myself. If it makes me happy, it means it's comfortable. Happiness and joy are two different things. Joy is not the higher level of happiness. The word happiness comes from the word hap, a Nordic word that translated, H-A-P-P, translated means quilt. Transliterated, meaning the practical meaning, is comfort. So money does buy happiness. It buys comfort. A pair of new shoes, happy. New mattress, happy. Clean sheets, happy. Right? I'm happy. I'm comfortable. But joy is something entirely different. Joy is divine by origin, completely. You cannot make yourself so happy that it turns into joy. Joy is a gift directly from God. The only way you can receive it is by clearing a path so that you can feel joy. That's why to some of us, most of us, we find a little baby giggling. We quit thinking about ourselves, and there's some nature in us that says, I need to protect this unprotected child. And for a moment, all our thought and soul hover over this baby, just for a moment, and we, boom, feel joy. It's amazing. We can feel joy in an instant watching baby ducks cross the road because we quit thinking about ourselves. Often when we're in service in this program, we start feeling joy. Another gift from God is peace. Tranquility is something we can do for ourselves. Calm. That's why in Latin or any Spanish language, there's two words for peace. One meaning calm, and one meaning a gift from God, which that gift is a knowledge, again, a clear viewpoint of exactly where you belong, of where you are, what thread you are in God's big, beautiful tapestry. When you suddenly realize you're a thread rolled with gold and blue and red and woven into this tapestry, and you belong exactly where you are, when you get that understanding, that clear recognition, that's peace. And you can hold on to it until you throw it out the window the next time you drive in Miami traffic. You go, I've worked so hard for this peace. You son of a... Oh, it's gone. Right? We are interesting human beings. We are beautiful human beings. Not only does God want you to be sober, not only does God want you to enjoy everything we have to offer, you can. It's in both these books. It's simple, easy to follow directions. It works every day. Every day we don't do it, it doesn't work. But not only can you do it, you are in fact entitled to it. And not only are you entitled to it, but you deserve it. Because it says in the family afterwards, in God's hands, your darkest past, all that horrible stuff you want to forget, in God's hands, your darkest past is transformed into your most precious possession. For with it, you will separate others from pain, misery, and sometimes death. What a gift that is. I don't know what I don't know, but I know what's in the book. And I know this, that the only place I have found God's purpose for me, what God wants me to do, right, is in this book. It's on the opposite page of my favorite page, which is 132, that says, we absolutely insist on enjoying life. Absolutely insist. I insist. We insist. Did you get that, Ryan? We insist on enjoying life. David, you enjoying life? We absolutely insist on it. Right? Are you enjoying life, sir? We absolutely insist on it. I don't care if you're drinking. I don't care if you're on your knees in the morning. I don't care how many meetings you went to. Are you enjoying life? We absolutely insist on it. And on the next page it says this. We are sure. Okay? That's pretty good. This book is meant to be suggestive only, except where they're absolutely sure. We are sure God wants. What does God want? We are sure God wants. What does he want? We are sure God wants us. Okay? To do what? We are sure God wants us to... What? Serve him and others and what? Damn it. Say it, man. We are sure God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. And that is God's will in three words. I am so privileged to have been asked to be here. Thank you so much, Doc Alcoholic.